Hello all, welcome to the God Said of Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Draconis Books. Kai Draconis Books is an independent anarchist press dedicated to publishing socially engaged literature. With me, as always, are the two other editors of Kai Draconis Books, Chris Malmberg and Hans Berger, and also a special guest, the esteemed poet Edward Kim. Is joining us as well today to talk about Ralph Ellison's The Invisible Man, which is a book I've been wanting to read for quite a while now. I remember starting it many years ago and then never finishing it, but this time around I did. So just to summarize the book, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man tells the story of one unnamed black man's journey into disillusionment. After being expelled from a Southern Negro college for taking a white trustee into the black section of town, the narrator goes to find work in Harlem. He first works at a paint factory, but loses this job when he has an altercation with his superior. However, he then finds work for the Brotherhood, an organization nominally designed for the advancement of blacks in Harlem and around the world. The Brotherhood approaches the narrator after he makes an impassioned speech in support of an elderly couple being evicted from their home by police. His speech leads to the assault of those police. After that, the Brotherhood employs the narrator to make similar rousing speeches for the black community. Later, though, he comes to feel that the Brotherhood has no real desire to improve the lives of blacks, and that the upper echelons of the group simply want to maintain their positions of power. He tries to take action in a number of ways, including seducing the wife of a member of the Brotherhood, but is unable to undermine the organization. Finally, during a riot in Harlem, he is chased by two white men and falls into a coal pit. The white men seal him inside, and in the coal pit, the narrator comes to fully comprehend the idea that he is an invisible man. So I thought we should start with the title, you know, the kind of the obvious thing. You know, what is this book trying to get at by using the metaphor of the invisible man? At first, my thought was, well, this is just like a metaphor for blackness or black identity, right? But I felt like that became much more complex and complicated as the novel went on. So I wanted to know what you guys thought about that, and I thought we should start out with that, and then we'll get to other things like, you know, how does the book examine identity? What is it saying about blackness? What about the ending of the novel? And maybe how does the novel compare specifically with the last thing we talked about on the podcast, which is the New York trilogy?
Well, I mean, I don't have as far as the question of the central metaphor of the invisible man and what statement that's making or how that is expressed in the events of the novel, I don't know off the top of my head if I have a particularly clear or well-articulated idea of that. I do think that it's more complex than just being invisible for being black, right? I wonder if it has more to do with the idea that there are certain roles and expectations that black people, or maybe even people in general, are allowed to have socially, and outside of those roles and expectations, you're perceived based on that role and that expectation, and not as a fully formed individual, that he as a person is invisible. What is seen is the role, or how he plays a role, or how he acts a particular place or position, right? And I'm thinking a bit of the Reinhard sequence, right? There's a period where he puts on a certain kind of sunglasses and all, and suddenly everybody in the neighborhood thinks that he is a character named Reinhard, who is this character named Reinhard who occupies this range of what I think are, and you guys can correct me on this, I'm I'm wobbly on a lot of this stuff, right? But it seems like Reinhardt occupies a lot of stereotypical black roles, right? He's a pimp. He's a charismatic preacher, right? He's a particular kind of hipster. So the Reinhardt is this person who is acting these conventional roles that are allowed to black people socially. And it's because the narrator's individuality is perceived so lightly, it's very easy for him to slip into the misperception of being this person who is more of a stereotype, less of an individual. I don't know. Is that, what do you guys think about that?
I would agree. That's like, I feel like my sense of things, particularly like you said, with that Reinhardt character, that, or that sequence, that there is that, that sort of invisibility through kind of stereotype, and through kind of, a lack of individualism, and to the point for me where it sort of feels like, the person themselves becomes sort of like invalid in a sort of sense of like not counting, because they're just like, anybody can play that role and you can slip into any one of said stereotype. And so that you have like no real sense of self or who you are. And you're not almost not allowed to have that.
And it seems like there's that disturbing aspect of it that I think you're getting at, Eddie. But there's also, I think he, like, as dismayed, as disturbed as the narrator is when he kind of comes to that realization, he's also kind of excited, like that integrity isn't really what's being asked of him. Did anyone else get that impression? I don't necessarily think it's like a simple positive thing, but there is a kind of a, at least in how that realization seemed to sort of wash over the narrator, and how he would then go on to sort of Reinhardt the Brotherhood. There is a kind of an excitement, a freedom in sort of in like not being held to who he is. He can put on these different faces. And I don't think that that's necessarily meant to be read as a real positive thing, but in the moment it's kind of exciting for him.
Right. Cause like you said, there's a certain level of the freedom from not being really seen for what your sort of intention is, just kind of what your outward appearance is. But then, cause like at the end of it, he talks about how like, it's like too much freedom. Or it'd be like the level of freedom that comes from being a Reinhardt was more than he could kind of cope with.
And it was actually in this sequence that we're talking about, and also in something else that you mentioned, Chris, you said like the Brotherhood they contacted him, but they don't want him to be, like, his integrity is not something that they care about. And it was really in this kind of instance where I feel like the metaphor of invisibility becomes more complex than just a representation of blackness, because, it isn't like the narrator isn't just invisible to white people, right? He's also seems to be invisible to other black people, to people in the Brotherhood. Like, you know, he is in the Brotherhood because he wants to like try to, you know, advance human rights causes and to be in, a person with integrity, and they don't seem to care about that. And that seems to be one way in which invisibility kind of veers away from just representing blackness. So I definitely agree that this is like, these are pivotal issue or scenes that we're addressing here. So like it almost seems like individuality itself is what causes individuality. I'm not sure if that makes sense.
Individuality is what causes individuality, you said?
Excuse me.
Did I parse
individuality
that right?
Is what causes invisibility. Mm-mm. I'm sorry about that.
Individuality about that. Causes individuality. Okay, yes. I think that's probably fair. Yeah, and I mean, I think that I'm trying to think now of other events in the novel in which the narrator is not seen, and some of those I think are... they're not necessarily just connected to race, right? Like thinking about there's a sequence where he gets a job at a paint factory, right. And at some point he goes into a union meeting and is thought by the people in the union meeting, they're suspicious of him because they think he's an infiltrator, right. And then he leaves the union meeting and goes to, you know, his new supervisor, and his new supervisor thinks that he's somehow being positioned by the union to force him out, right? So it's not just that. In both cases, there are expectations that are being put on him that are, I think, in that instance, much more to do with economics and class and labor issues, right, than they are strictly with race. And those also cause him to be unperceived, right? There's sort of a hole in the shape of him, and people are filling in whatever expectations they have from that situation.
But even within that scene, right, didn't that, like, that manager, it was like, well, they've never sent a black person down here. They've always sent like white people. Yeah. And so because of that, he like thinks of him as like not somebody who is necessarily, he's less of a threat, it seems, to take his job.
Right. Because that's what the guy in the boiler room is worried about.
Yeah, and he still thinks of it sort of as a tactic, but he's less certain about it than when they send white workers down there.
Right.
So this is kind of touching on something that like occurred to me. I don't think that the connection is maybe enough to build anything on, but it sort of touches on something I think you guys are saying, which is he's black, but I also think that the other aspect that kind of puts him in a particular sort of like slot to be mistrusted or ignored or to have things projected upon him is his articulate sort of thoughtful conviction, you know, like he speaks up, he has the speech that he gives in that really awful opening scene where he's in the battle royale, and then in the end he's confronting, is it Uncle Jack? So the connection in my head, because of kind of his kind of, he seems kind of mad, you know, sort of at the end, and sort of the frame from which he's speaking, it reminded me of Moby Dick a little bit, just like Ishmael being in this kind of questionable state of mind, and also Ishmael kind of always getting made fun of in the very beginning anyway, or in the beginning and parts of the first half of the book, for just being kind of articulate and sort of kind of weird, kind of sticking out among all these salty sort of hard people. And I don't know, like you mentioned the fact that he's black. I think like the fact that he's black and really articulate and thoughtful, it seemed to me sort of put him in these positions where just sort of like maybe a more specific thing than his individuality. It's like he is not being seen, and I feel like, and you guys can push back on this, that it's like both his race and his like his desire to and his ability to articulate what he's feeling and express himself and be, it kind of puts him in this sort of outlier status. And I just don't know. I don't know. Did you guys, does that gel with what you're saying? I'm just thinking of like something more specific to me in terms of like, it's not just, you know, an individual who's not seen. It's someone who doesn't fit, who's not seen. And he doesn't fit in the Brotherhood, in Harlem. No matter where he goes, he doesn't fit. At college, he doesn't fit. Mm.
No, he does. You're absolutely right. He doesn't seem to fit anywhere. Not at the not at the Brotherhood. Not at college. Not at the paint factory. Which, you know, kind of, I guess, kind of, I would take to kind of support my main thought that like the issue of invisibility is very complex, and like what it seems like Ellison is really concerned with is not generalizing about blackness so much as discussing. I mean, he's definitely talking about black, you know, black identity and black experience, but you know, he's also specifically, I think, trying to point out that it isn't uniform, right? Like it's, you know, on the one hand, you have black people like Reinhardt or black people like the upper members of the Brotherhood or, you know, you have, you know, various different types of people, various different personalities inhabiting black identity. And so maybe the idea of invisibility is that, you know, black identity is not one thing. It's many things. I don't know. That seems like a postmodern cliche, but it may be true. Did I just pull that out of my ass?
Does it smell like it?
No.
I mean, it didn't seem stinky to me.
To me, it smelled like roses or something great. Mm.
No, I mean, I do think that those things are very multifaceted, and I do think because we're kind of like presented with a lot of different types of like characters and stereotypes, I think, of identity, and it's like I don't know, I'm not really sure what idea I'm trying to get to, but it is like a thing where I feel it's an exploration within like a critique of what is allowed and what people choose to kind of see, as opposed to what people just of just being and who people are allowed to just kind of be and are.
Is that why True Blood gets money from more help, more assistance from white people after he impregnates his daughter? Because that's like an approved, as much as it's a terrible thing, and it's an amazing, awful scene. You know, he's expressing that he gets more help, and then is he a trustee or I don't remember who the white guy is.
Mr. Norton is a trustee of the college.
Yeah. Yeah. He gives him $100 bill, and it's like mind blowing to the narrator. And is that because what True Blood did is just sort of like, as awful as it is in a vacuum, it fits within just sort of like, oh, like this is an afflicted person. And the thing that he is afflicted by is he is black. Right. And
like there's like a lack of threat.
Yeah, and it's sort of like, and even if it's a bad thing, it's a bad thing that's like, it's a bad thing that fits into like the schema that already exists in Norton's mind.
Yeah, then like his narrative and other white people's mind. And,
yeah,
and it helps to reestablish a sort of, well, not reestablish, but just kind of confirm like a hierarchy, right? It keeps him in his position of power and kind of handing down favors and help and making himself feel better about, you know, who he is as a person by doing those things.
Yeah, and he's handing that down to someone who is as terrible and shocking as it is, it's secretly or in some fundamental way fits an idea of what he must think black people must happen in their community. Like, this is what this is what I intend to lift them
it's
up.
It's sort of like the white savior complex, right? It's like, I'm here to help you be better, you know? And these are these are the types of people that I'm here to help, you know, like, type of, you know, stuff is,
and that's definitely supported by the fact that he's a trustee of specifically a Southern Negro college, mm-hmm. right? Like, he's, you know, here I am helping these poor people in their, you know, poor circumstances, you know?
Right.
So that's interesting.
But it's really just to kind of make them feel, oh, sorry, Hans, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and I don't know if this will go anywhere as a line of analysis. I'm just thinking out loud, but it's interesting if the trustee is engaged by the idea of reinforcing those hierarchies, if he finds that satisfying, if it plays into, you know, as you said, Eddie, the white savior complex. It's interesting then that the narrator gets in so much trouble for exposing the trustee to that situation, right? Because if the trustee's role as trustee of a black college is coming from that kind of white savior complex, that impulse, then it almost seems like being exposed to that kind of poverty and degradation in the black community on the True Blood Ranch, and then also in the Golden Dawn, the bar that they go to, the kind of horrid bar full of mental patients and sex workers, right?
Yeah.
A Golden Day. Yeah. It's interesting that Bledsoe, the administrator at the college, is so opposed to his seeing that, right? And I mean, I understand why he would be, right? Like, it makes logical sense that this is something you would want to protect this person from. But if the subtext of what we're thinking here is that that person's urge to help is actually rooted in those stereotypes of degradation, then ultimately it would be actually perversely productive for him to have that experience. Or am I misunderstanding the point?
I think, like, that's, we're describing, like, I think, like, you could turn the setup of the novel on its head, and you could have the college engaged in sort of systematic sort of like abuse of that, of Norton's, you know, desire to sort of support these people and lift them up. And so it'd be like, oh, Norton's visiting, so make sure you drive him to the Golden Day and go see True Blood. And then you'd have the narrator disgusted by this like abuse of a white person who's done so much to help them. There's a weird way in that makes sense, like, as almost like in an alternative universe, Hans, like a different storyline that would be like really, I think it, you know, that's actually kind of electrifying my brain thinking about it, because I think it does, like, I think that, like, it you know, it makes more sense the way it is written, because this isn't something that is explicit. Like, it would make something explicit too early in the novel in the relationship between, right. I think that kind of maybe kind of, it foregrounds the wrong, the thing that is meant to kind of sort of sit behind the scenes for, you know, just too early. But I like that idea. That's kind of a cool story.
Well, and I don't mean that at all as a critique of the novel, right? I think, like, what does happen is very intelligible, and it's in line with, you know, how we understand the character of the Administrator Bledsoe. I think it suggests some of the difficulties of how, it suggests some of the complexities of how you relate to the question of suffering and aid and all those topics.
But I would also say that a person like the character of Norton doesn't actually want to see, like, the truth behind the story. They want to see the end result. But they're not at really, like, they may say that they're interested in, like, in that, you know, the roots of where people are coming from and the kind of backstories, but I don't think they want to actually see it. And that's why he can't handle it when he goes to see it. And it's why he has, like, a spell or whatever and passes out, because he can't handle it. And his mind can't really wrap around the whole thing. And so what they want to see are the students in the hall, you know, singing along or, you know, listening to speeches and sermons, and being kind of like these quote unquote, like, finished products of the program that he's invested in.
I had a side question, and maybe the answer to this isn't relevant. Maybe this is a dead end. Maybe it gets cut, but the True Blood segment is so, so strange. It's like when he narrates the dream that he has while he's getting his daughter pregnant, or the dream that leads him to do that. That's so, I mean, there's a certain level of surrealism throughout the novel, right? Like it's right. Like one tick. If you, like, take the surrealism dial and you turn it, like, one tick above straight realism, that's where it is.
Right.
And there are some places where that's much more evident than others, right? Like the explosion in the paint factory, it gets into much more of almost what we would now think of as a cartoonish territory. Whereas, you know, the experiences he has with the Brotherhood and the riots in Harlem, those seem to me like a more kind of grounded in what you would think of as a realistic approach.
Right.
But because, I think partly because the novel sits in this kind of halfway point between straight realism and more of a kind of surreal quality, an exaggerated kind of quality, it was very, very hard for me to know what to make of True Blood's dream, True Blood's narration. Is he making some kind of grotesque excuse? Are we meant to understand that that's a literal description of a thing that happened to him? What is that? I don't know. Do you guys have any thoughts about that? I found it stupefying.
Well, my initial thought is that it kind of starts off the because you're right, like, there's, like, if we have a dial that reads, like, on one end realism and in the other end, you know, surrealism, like, we tick it one little step towards surrealism, but it seems to me that, like, the surrealism, and it starts here with True Blood, it has this, like, quality of interrupting the narrative with, like, this phantasmagoria, was the word that kind of, like, every now and then we like interrupt the narrative realism to have one of these phantasmagoric moments. And so, like, I don't know about whether or not we're supposed to take it literally, but it definitely contributes to this quality of surrealism. And I was wondering what the surrealism itself does, you know, like, so let's say that just like, I like it. I like to think this way, that we don't take it literally, that True Blood is kind of coming up with some excuse, you know, like, or either he's coming up with an excuse or he himself is so disgusted with his actions that he, like, you know, tries to rationalize his motivations in this way, like, tries to say, well, it was a dream. It was a lucid dream in which, you know, like, I'm, you know, I end up having sex with my daughter. So let's just say it didn't literally happen. It's just this dream. And from there we could ask, well, what is the surrealism, which this is an excellent example of, what does that do for the novel? Like, is it, I mean, this little True Blood section is horrific. So I'm not sure.
Well, I think that one thing that the surrealism maybe does is, and I don't know if I can articulate this thought very well, right? But like, there's an effect, I think, where there are things in the novel that we understand as surreal, and there are things in the novel that we understand maybe as more literally true. But I think that there's something in the haziness of the boundary between those things that is a little bit haunting, right? Like the Battle Royale sequence at the beginning. It has some aspect of, it feels like something that might really happen in that time, right? It sits in this kind of liminal space where, to us now, you can't, it's very hard to tell if it is the surreal exaggeration or if it is something that really would have happened in that time and place, right? Same thing goes, I think, for some of the riots at the end, right? And for the, there's a sequence where one character torches a tenement as a protest against the terrible living conditions that black people in Harlem had to live in, right? And I think that there's sort of an aesthetic effect where, by taking these things that are more overtly surreal and these things that are these things that have this kind of cosmic awfulness, but which actually aren't quite surreal, there's a suggestion of, it evokes the idea that there is a kind of that living as a black person in Harlem or the South, you kind of encounter these conditions that are so strange and so awful and so that they have the character of the surreal, even though they are literal experiences. Mm. Right? Does that make sense?
Sure. But and that interpretation would read better with True Blood, you know, like him recounting the thing that actually happened, right?
Yeah, it could. Huh. Yeah.
Interesting.
It's I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, it's a technique for, it, you could read it as a technique for revealing the underlying surrealism or the strangeness, the kind of horrific Kafkaesque strangeness of actual literal life in that time and place.
Right. Oh, that, yeah, that like just like blew it open for me, actually, when you said Kafkaesque. Okay. Right. Cause like, you know, everybody's read The Metamorphosis, or metamorphosis. The metamorphosis is by Ovid. You know, like Gregor Samsa wakes up as a giant bug, and you know, like we're meant to understand that, like, this is his experience of life, right? Like, you know, he is an outsider. He's estranged from everything and everyone, but nobody seems to notice or give a shit. And that, like, that very concept seems to be, like, mirrored or being examined in this novel. Yeah, Han, as usual, Hans, like, is the smartest one of us. And says
that's
something.
Why he makes the big bucks.
Yeah, exactly.
It makes me really uncomfortable when you butter me up in, like, the actual podcast that people will hear.
All right. I'll cut this out. My bad.
It's one thing if you swap my knob behind the scenes, right? But, like, on air, it's a whole other matter.
I can edit this so that, you know, you're not embarrassed.
No, don't. Please leave that compliment in.
Secretly, he likes it.
I don't right, know whether right. you're being serious or not right now. I can't tell. So I'll just do whatever the fuck I want. I'll just do whatever the fuck I want. You know, nobody, you know, it's not like you guys are going to, like, get on here and listen to it. It's like, so it won't really hurt anything.
Kafka is a good, I'm trying to think of another compare. Like, there's something about there's something kind of catch 22-ish later about, like, the true goals of the Brotherhood and how, you know, the narrator finds himself in this sort of larger system that is kind of ignoring the value of individual human life, or just completely, like, you know, at least ignoring his value as a person and seemingly, like, playing multiple games at once. And then I think that there's that Kafka element in True Blood getting support for being more awful, because awfulness is what is expected of him. And there, you know, like, you can follow that line. And I guess, like, well, I don't know where to take that necessarily.
Like,
thought I had
the Brotherhood thing aspect of the story is, like, well, one aspect of it that was really disturbing to me is, like, how I feel like irrelevant that that kind of portrayal is, like, to just current events. There are certain aspects of parts of like when I read descriptions about, like, the Brotherhood and what's, like, you know, just like upper class white society in here, where it just starts to sound like it's talking about the Democratic Party at times. And it's, like, terrifying.
Sure.
It's, like, utterly terrifying.
Oh, man. I know.
How about the portrayal, like, they say science. And that's an interesting, yeah. Science is said a lot, and it seemed to carry a weight. I didn't know really what to do with it. Did anyone else catch or think about that?
That's, like, a great question. I did start to think about that, but I didn't really know what to make of it. I mean, in some aspects, it started to border on, like, you know, like, notions of, like, eugenics to me, but it's, like, I feel like they talk about it, but they don't really dive into it enough to get a full picture.
Well, it's like he goes to, God, what's his name? The guy he goes to when he's discovering the Reinhardt thing, you know, and he's talking to him about the program, and I can't remember, is it Hasbro?
Hambro.
I think Hasbro is in my head because
you were playing Magic the Gathering.
I could deal with a game of good old Magic. But the
Chub Toad, as Hans would say.
Well, he mentions, like, science, and Jack before mentions science, and it's like like we're led by science, and I just didn't know.
That was an interesting, like his final like discussion with Jack, and Jack is like, you know, like we're led by science. Yeah, that's an interesting kind of like is that a dig at science, like to say that like this person whom we are supposed to kind of disapprove of is invoking it to justify his actions, or is it more like this person obviously doesn't really know what science is?
You know what it comes to mind? Replace the word science with data. Replace the word science with data. And then it feels really modern, right? Because it's like we're watching the data.
Right.
You know, don't worry about it.
Right.
It's like then it becomes a, and I wonder if like there's like ghosts of the kind of criticisms of big data that exists today, even like 70 years ago,
right,
but not of big data, but of kind of the anti-humanistic sort of like elements of science. Like, right, hey, you know, we're being scientific about this. And it's like, well, yeah, fine, but there's human lives that matter, and science is blind to that. Mm-hmm. And or is that maybe the way to read it? Because I feel like if I take out science and I put data, basically wherever they mention science, it makes a lot of sense suddenly.
I think that's
what they're talking about.
Yeah, it does seem like we use the word data now the same way Jack's using the word science. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the data tells us everything. Like, all we need is the data, and, you know, we can do anything we need to do. That's interesting. Very interesting.
Does that say something then about like about the minority experience, you know, in terms of like advocating for advocating for themselves, advocating for like to be seen as an individual, and then like there's some way in which sort of like science in this book, data in my head, like plays a role in sort of like acknowledging the need of the person, you know, like yes, of course, and then somehow being entirely blind to it at the same time. Like you mentioned the Democratic Party, Eddie, and it's like we're taking care of it and we're watching the data, and there's something like you're not invited into this conversation about your life,
right,
about you. because you know, like we have the data. It's all right. We got it. We're playing the game for you.
Well,
so just sit back.
I wonder if there might be, and I'm asking this as a question, is there something disanalogous between Jack invoking science and the Democratic Party in the idea in that, is Jack actually sincere? You know, does he actually think that he's doing the right thing? Whereas we all know Democrats know that they're not doing anything good. They just, you know, because they're cowards. They
no,
want,
I don't
they
know. That's true, man.
I'd be willing to bet that they've at least convinced themselves that they're doing the right thing.
Okay,
I think
so
almost
they,
everybody thinks they're doing the
yeah,
right thing.
Yeah,
I mean, everybody in the whole world, 99% of all people think they're doing the right thing.
Yeah, and they feel justified.
Whether they are or not
oh,
is
yeah,
an entirely different matter, but I think almost everybody justifies their own actions pretty skillfully. And I think, of course, Jack thinks he's doing the right thing.
100%, right, okay, yeah.
And I can't like dig into great textual evidence, but I'm sure he does, yeah.
Sure. That makes sense. Yeah. We all believe in the lies we tell ourselves.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Except for me. I
from your unique position of enlightenment. Yeah.
Right, exactly. From my unique position of enlightenment, as everybody should know, you know, I'm uniquely enlightened.
You read a bunch of moral philosophy books, so.
Right, exactly. Know. So that makes me, you know, singularly, along with all the moral philosophers themselves,
Other than the ones you disagree with.
Other than the ones I... Yeah, exactly. Okay, yeah, we can... we don't have to keep going with that joke. It's definitely not.
Oh, there's a great line that he had on here that I'm trying to find about, like, whether there is room for love in politics, or that it's possible to have love in politics, or something like that. But it was like, I read it, and it was just like utterly kind of depressing question for me to consider, because I just I don't really see, and especially in like modern politics, it's, I feel like love is sort of like a currency that's used, you know, but it's not really as a foundational basis for doing things and caring about your, you know, fellow citizen or whatever, but it's not practiced really. It's just kind of used as currency, like military troops and whatnot.
So maybe one last question to, like, you know, close things out. You know, if we want to, you know, keep it around an hour or so, I was wondering, you know, we've talked about how the, you know, the novel's kind of exploring a lot of awful things, a lot of negative things. But I was wondering, is its understanding of identity and how it shifts, like, that didn't strike me as wholly negative. So, just to bring up a comparison, we talked about the New York trilogy last time, and it seemed like in that novel or series of novels, identity shifting, specifically identity loss or identity uncertainty, seemed to be a very negative thing. Like, it just in general, it seemed to be a very not positive thing. Like the first gumshoe type character ends up, like, kind of losing his sense of self entirely. And then in the final novella, the main character, like, you know, definitely loses his sense of self before ultimately maybe coming back to his sense of self. But in this novel, there was a specific incident where the narrator is recalling Frederick Douglass and how, you know, Frederick Douglass chose that name for himself. Like, he whatever his slave name was, I'm not sure what it was, but, like, when he educated himself, he got out of slavery, and he, you know, he became Frederick Douglass. So, like, and the narrator seems to view that shift into from lack of identity or identity as uneducated slave to, you know, maybe one of the most important abolitionist thinkers of all time, you know, that seemed like a positive shift. Are there other positive shifts that we can think of, or is this an outlier? Just kind of, does it not have any more significance than I think it might?
That's a really interesting example, actually. I think because, you know, when you mentioned identity, how changes of identity function in the novel, I was thinking of mostly examples that tend to involve cynical manipulation for power or wealth or sex, right? Mm. We've already talked about the ways in which, you know, the main character gives this kind of spontaneous speech, and that leads to him being invited into the Brotherhood but to participate in the Brotherhood, which gives him economic power, he has to kind of let go, or he has to allow them to shape the identity of what it is that he's trying to say, right?
Right.
Or, you know, there's a very, very uncomfortable scene where he's about to have sex with a drunk woman, and they're both drunk, but he's about to have sex with a woman, and she is encouraging him to kind of play the role of this beast and brute and a rape fantasy, right? Like, and there's way in which he's being invited to cynically change his identity as a way of kind of getting sexual advantage, right? And so most of the instances of change in identity that I was thinking of were cynical manipulation toward power, right? But you've found an instance, and that was a very interesting. I completely was not thinking about that. That's an instance where a not totally different technique maybe is being employed toward a noble end, and I think that's an interesting contrast. I wonder if. And I couldn't begin to argue for sure one way or the other, but I wonder if what Douglas is doing is not so much when Douglas picks the new name, is he taking on a new identity, or is he finding and affirming some kind of more central identity?
Right. Mm.
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, but that's super interesting. Like, because I hadn't, you know, I certainly noticed these like little anecdotes and little sections that you're talking about, but I hadn't necessarily connected him with the idea of shifting identity. But they definitely fit. So it's very interesting to see the contrast between the Frederick Douglass example and the other examples that you gave. And that is like, that's the question, right? Like, is identity shifting not good, but finding the real authentic identity good? And is the novel maybe afraid that there can be no, like, uncoverable authentic identity, at least in the narrator's case, you know, ending up
I was
in
wondering
his,
about that, right?
Yeah, ending up in his,
because you've used the P word a couple times, right? Postmodern.
Yeah.
And I think postmodernism would say that the idea of a core authentic identity is illusory, right?
Right,
and
right,
it
right.
Seems like maybe part of what's happening here is, and this is probably an oversimplification, right? But like Frederick Douglass was able to find, shape, refine, bring forward some kind of authentic core identity, and the narrator thus far is unable to do so.
Right.
And there's a kind of horror in that, right?
Right, exactly.
It's interesting that I don't think anybody's answered your question about New York Trilogy. There's a very major distinction there, I think, right? Where in New York Trilogy, change in identity or dissolution of identity is associated with powerlessness, right? It's associated with decay. It's associated with oblivion. And here, I think the more fluid one is in one's identity, the more one is able to gain power. They seem to me very kind of diametrically opposed in that way.
Right.
I sort of, my view of the identity shifts in Invisible Man are sort of, I don't know if I see them as like, specifically negative or positive. I think I generally lean towards positive, but I almost in the sense because like the identities that most of the characters have, and particularly the narrator, aren't really necessarily identities that seemed like ones that they kind of came to on their own. There are more identities that were placed upon them or expected of them. And so because of that, I feel like the change towards the end for me is actually positive, even though he's not necessarily like in like I mean, he hasn't like, yeah, he hasn't like won like or whatever, right. You know, but he is in a situation where there's a certain kind of balance to his thinking toward at the very end. And a sort of acceptance of possibility of what his identity could be and who he could be as a person. And so it's like, and so for me, when you talk about that Frederick Douglass, section, it's sort of like an opportunity to create your own identity. If you've constantly had identity foisted upon you of a certain kind, then there's a certain reclamation that happens, I think, when you get to like choose your own name and like determine who you are going to be as a person. Right. You're taking back sort of control over your humanity and your narrative. Right. And
absolutely.
And for me, that's a positive thing, right? Like, you know, like that's
right.
And I would also say that it's for the character, at least it seems like inevitable that there's going to be like an identity shift.
Right. Is it inevitable plot wise or just theme wise? Because like he remarks in the beginning, like, you know, that this is a journey about him being an invisible man, becoming an invisible man. But maybe that question doesn't make any sense, actually.
Yeah. But I mean, because I would say that like within the book, like I would say that you could view like a lot of the kind of like, I guess, you know, authoritative figures of whichever kind, basically trying to place specific types of identity on the narrator.
Right.
You know, from Absolutely. When he's at school, like with Bledsoe, to, you know, to when he's with Norton, to when he's, you know, in the city, and to with the Brotherhood, like they have a very specific agenda for what they want like his identity to be and or what they feel like it should be. And it's, you know, mostly towards their own ends, not for anything that he wants to do or what his desire is or his, you know, aspiration is. They're all kind of adopted from what they have decided. Mm-hmm.
And that would actually go for the examples Hans brought up too. Like the woman, the drunk woman that, you know, wants him to act like a rapist.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That would be like an example of her, you know, trying to foist this identity on him.
Right.
That's super
right.
Interesting.
And because I think she's like, you know how to do it. You know how to do this thing. You know, like
oh, yeah, you're right.
She's like, you're like it's natural to you. Just let it go. You know, just let it out. And so that idea, like her notion of his authentic, you know, identity is something completely different. So I don't think we actually really know. And I would say that like almost the character probably doesn't know what their authentic identity is. And there are maybe moments of it, you know, like there's that part when he's like, you know, fights to not eat a pork chop because he's like, I'm not going to show them like, you know, what kind of person I am or where I'm from.
Right.
By eating a pork chop. Which is like was utterly depressing because I was like, eat the pork chop, man. Like I wanted to eat the pork chop. I was like, eat the pork chop.
Pork chop's on the menu for me tonight, actually. So,
oh Lord,
do you think Eddie? One of the questions that Patrick had put in the kind of the pre-work was what the ending of the novel portends, right? And whether the narrator will live insane in a coal pit or if he will emerge kind of with new, if he will emerge with renewed focus and fight in a new way. And it sounds like you think he might emerge and fight.
I kind of lean towards
that. Or that he can't if he doesn't. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. Go ahead. I do lean towards that way. I do like I feel my interpretation of the last like couple pages. For me, there's sort of like a clarity in his thinking. It may not be decisive at that point, but there seems like there's a certain lightness to it that felt like I'm seeing things more clearly now, and I'm accepting them as they are, but I'm also going to go, you have to do something, is sort of what the impression that I got, that he felt like a need to do something.
Yeah.
I would like to believe that that way is the way that the novel ends. I'd like to believe.
Well,
I'm not sure, but that's what I want.
Yeah, that's just.
I guess I think of this book as being, and maybe I'm reading too much into this. I think of it as being, maybe psychologically, thematically autobiographical, if not literally autobiographical, right? So just the fact that Ralph Ellison lived the life that he did is a positive sign in a way, right? Like his authentic life that he was able to live from a similar kind of psychological vantage point suggests that if he was able to discover it was possible, then the narrator could too.
Sure. Excellent. I like that. Let's wrap up there with this image of hope.
Okay.
Does that sound good?
Works for me.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So normally what we do at this point is ask the next person in line what their pick is. But I wondered, Eddie, like, the invitation for you to join the podcast is open whenever you want.
Oh,
you
know? I appreciate that. Thank you.
if you wanted to like come on every time, you absolutely could. Is that something you want to do, or you don't think you have the time?
Just now I couldn't commit to it every time.
Okay.
But but I definitely like enjoy doing this, so I would definitely like to come back.
All right.
Well, I like how you wanted to entrap him by having him commit before he heard what the next book was. Right.
Yeah, I was definitely trying to like put him on the spot and entrap him. Definitely. So if you know, as I said, open invitation, you just message me on Facebook or email me or something and be like, hey, it'd be fun to like join again. Like, what are you guys reading next time?
Yeah.
But if you said you were going to join full time, I was going to let you pick next time. But since you're not, Chris, what did you pick?
I picked a book that you might hate, like you and Hans might really hate.
Both of us?
Maybe. I read it. It came out only a few years ago, and I read it when it came out because it sounded very bizarre. It's called The Vor by Brian Catling.
V-O-R?
I read that.
The Vor?
Oh, you read it?
Yeah, I read it, Hans? Yeah. I think I read it on your recommendation, actually. It was either either it was your recommendation or I was seeing it a lot in people's OkCupid profiles, and I thought, well, I should be conversant with this to get laid. One of the two.
Yeah. I don't know if you can be conversant in it.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that is hilarious.
That is like not my thought process ever.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd have recommended it to you, Hans.
Pink is eye rolling again somewhere.
Exactly. Yeah. Jacob's very upset.
Yeah, he's like, what?
It's a very bizarre, fragmentary novel written by a poet. It's his first novel. It doesn't cohere in my memory at all. I just remember bits and pieces of it just sticking out in like a vivid kind of way. I can't really decide in my memory if it's erudite in how it handles like issues of colonialism and like, again, I'm kind of going back to the early 1900s. I just am kind of fascinated with that time, but like early 1900s in Africa, deep kind of on the edge of where basically modern, at the time, the modern world sort of ends. and this idea of the deep mysteries of the Vor, of the unexplored wilderness, and then like science. Do you remember it fondly, Hans? I can change it if you don't remember it fondly. It's a very strange book, and I can't even decide if it was good. I enjoyed it, the experience of it, but what did you remember of it?
To answer your question, Chris, I remember enjoying it. Yeah, I remember enjoying it. The thing that I remember being most impressed by, actually, was that, well, shoot, I guess this is kind of a spoiler, so I won't say anything. There's a thing that I remember being impressed by, and then later I found out that it was going to be part of a trilogy, and that made that thing less impressive for me if it was not a freestanding book.
That's all
I'll say.
I have not read the other two or this. I don't know if all the other two have come out yet. I kind of haven't acknowledged the other two. Like, that's a weird thing. Like, I wonder if you and I kind of sort of think similarly about it. Like, as a freestanding novel, and it's very bizarre, and I kind of want it to stand on its own as this sort of thing. And so if we can kind of talk about that, and I think that I'd be interested in sort of like talking about whether its pieces are, because I think it's, some of its pieces are very, very dramatic and interesting and strange, and but whether those pieces actually come together to make something that's impressive and beautiful, or just sort of memorable for being so bizarre. Patrick, the audiobook, I have both the physical and the audiobook copy, because I listened to it first, but then I was really kind of captivated by the sentence construction of it. Mm-hmm. It's really, on a sentence level, very, very, very good, very, very captivating anyway for me. And so I got the physical copy and sort of like, I didn't read the physical copy. I sort of like studied bits and pieces of it, because I thought that, you know, maybe I could learn a little bit about how to be a less shitty writer from it. But it's the audio copy is amazing. Like, it's really good. It's a really well done, like, the guy that they got to do it is doing, he does such an amazing job, and it's so, it's kind of like this weird, surreal nightmare, the whole book kind of taken together, and he does a really excellent job with it. So, cool. Let's do it. Hans, if you don't strongly object, having read it, let's choose it, and we can decide whether it's good or not. It doesn't occupy the same sort of space in the canon as Invisible Man. So if we choose to shit on it, then we just shit on it with relish.
Right,
so.
Yeah, like, we can't shit on Invisible Man.
No, we really can't. That's really excellent. Not possible.
Patrick,
It's great.
In a similar boat as you, where I think in college I like was meant to read at least sections of it or something. So I read like parts of it when I was in college, but I never finished it, and it was always something that I wanted to return to and finish.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm glad that we did.
Yeah, I'm glad I did. Like, it's a classic, and it's a good book. Yeah.
It earns it. Yeah. I think, so like, people asked about, you were asking about True Blood. I think the True Blood dream sequence is in there just so Hellison like tells you early on that he's not fucking around. Like, that, sure. That's like you read that, like, I think like retrospectively, like I read that and I'm like, oh, this is like a 70-year-old book, and this is like,
right,
crazy.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And suddenly now I'm excited. You know, before I was like, oh,
it's 100% relevant, like all of it, like
absolutely.
So like it could have been written like, you know, last month, really, and it would be like.
But Eddie, there's a lot of relevant stuff that is just not.
No. It's like
there's a gigantic stack of relevant shit that I don't like enjoy reading. Yeah. This was actually Invisible Man was enjoyable,
and this one was like depressingly relevant.
Absolutely.
Well, True Blood describing his wife with the axe. Jesus, man, Jesus. There we go.
That was like when that True Blood sequence hit, you're like, oh fuck, this is real.
Strap in.
This is a real deal. He's not He's not like euphemizing anything. Okay, listeners. You know, I hope you enjoyed our discussion of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. Eddie, I wanted to give you a special thanks for coming on. It's awesome to talk with you.
Yeah, great to talk with you.
It's fantastic. And, you know, as I said, you're welcome back on anytime you want. Just hit me up.
Thank you.
Or hit, you know, Chris or Hans up.
Will do. Will do. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me. It's great to catch up with you guys in this way.
Yeah, definitely.
So, comrades, peace out until next time.